will unify, then they must certainly lose the Asian mainland. September 18, 1931. Attack begins, which Marshal Jiang Suliang's warlord soldiers cannot stop, and Chiang Kai-shek is powerless to help. Striking simultaneously at half a dozen different points, the soldiers of Japan seize towns and rails. By spring of 32, they hold all Manchuria, rename it Manchukuo, a puppet state at their command. Rage sweeps China. Generals exhort their troops to stand by for the counterblow, demand a war of national resistance to Japan, right now. For Zhang, the problem pinches. His foot soldier armies may be stronger than old warlord armies, yet they lack tanks, have old artillery, are just beginning to understand the airplane. He knows they cannot match the modern weapons of Japan. Not only that, he leads a nation still divided. The communists, struck down for good in 1927, have somehow swelled by 32 to major force again.
It was as if a ghost had risen from the dead. When Mao had fled in 27 with his 1,000 communist zealots, he was already disgusted with Borodin and clumsy Russian doctrine. He felt the key to revolution in Asia lay in the peasants of the countryside, not the big city proletariat. 80% of all China's peasants lived in bleak and filthy villages, treated like brutes, imprisoned by officials, landlords, loan sharks, and Mao's idea was simple. Turn the hidden peasant anger against the local gentry, the local rich, as well as the unknown foreigner. Let terror claim revenge by stealth and night. Use pitchfork, guns, knives, grenades. Give guns to anger. And out of this idea, he created this black miracle of his, the doctrine of partisan warfare. Divide the land among the landless. Rip out roads, bridges, railways, so that formal armies will have to slog on foot, dissolve in garrisons, bog down. Transform the countryside into a total environment of hate. Let women, children, everyone, not be afraid to die. Was political warfare raised to the nth degree, and by 1932, he controlled a good chunk of the two provinces of Hunan and Jiangxi and claimed the loyalty of 9 million people.
Zhang insists he cannot resist Japan unless he first has crushed this enemy within. From 1930 to 1935, he drives his troops to fight. His narrow military politics sees only one solution. Force must root out Mao's ideas with bayonets. With communism, no compromise. Year after year, this civil war goes on as expedition after expedition grinds into failure in peasant ambuscade, guerrilla war. An American newsreel of the early 1930s innocently reports this nameless civil war.
Trouble China turns on the enemy within her gates. These bombing planes of the Nanking government get ready to attack the rebel strongholds in Chiang Sai. Contact! High over the mountains, movie tone flies with the air forces of President Chiang Kai-shek. This is an actual bombing raid, and as we sight the first of the rebel villages, we commence the attack. Chiang Kai-shek is making desperate efforts to unite the various provinces of China, many of which are torn by internal dissension. And if he can't do it one way, he tries another, including bombs. China, Far East, land of ancient culture, land of bloodshed, rebellion, and war.
By 1934, Zhang has forged a blockhouse ring around Mao's communists, and squeezing ever tighter, feels certain they are trapped.
One of the most amazing episodes in history. As Zhang squeezed, they oozed. Dissolving into tight bands, they oozed through his fingers. In October 34, 90,000 men and women set out. Not just an army, but the government. an idea carrying all their records with them on these little yo-yo sticks on what they called the Long March. It's a 1,000-mile trek they made from Jiangxi in Hunan, south to Guizhou and up to the Guizhou Plateau, and up across the foothills of Tibet, and then down again out of the mountains, down into Shensi, where in these dry and windswept hills, they made their base. 90,000 had set out. They arrived a year later in October 1935, 20,000 left, and there they were to dig in. This is how Westerners saw them in these yellow barren hills, where, calling peasants to their cars, they finally fended off Jiang's pursuit.
In 1936, however, Mao's line changes. He calls for unity against Japan. Rich and poor must stand together, an end to civil war. Nationalist, communist, warlord, all must stand as brothers against the alien threat. This new line appeals to millions, but not to Chiang Kai-shek. He, his inner councils, and his generals persist. Final mop-up of the communists must still go on, entrusted now to friendly warlords in the north. Yet mysteriously, this final mop-up stalls. The most important front against the communists is held by soldiers of Manchuria, driven out by Japanese. These homesick troops have little stomach for killing other Chinese. Led by young Marshal Jiang Su-liang, they itch to tackle Japanese. In December 1936, Jiang flies off to see the young Marshal in Xi'an, to flog him on to sterner effort. In Xi'an, however, communists have convinced the young Marshal that civil war must stop.
Then there happens one of those episodes that sound as if they were written in the book of make-believe. And again, we have no photographs because no one invites a photographer to witness a kidnapping, which was what happened next. Jiang was there to urge them to fight the communists. And on the night of December 11th, he was sleeping in a villa outside of town when he was awakened by gunfire. And the young marshal and his troops were shooting their way into his villa and trying to kidnap him. Jiang was in his nightshirt and bare feet. He slipped out the back way, tried to climb over the wall, fell. He hurt his back. He lost his false teeth. His feet were bleeding as he ran over the rocks. And the young marshal's soldiers caught him and brought him back. It sounds mad, but that's the way China was, and it got even madder. Because when they brought him back, they invited the communists down from North Shanxi, and on December 15th, the communists, the young marshal, and Jiang all sat down to talk. The communists and the young marshal said to Chiang Kai-shek, "It's time to end the civil war. We must all unite against the Japanese, or else." They could have killed him, but they didn't. And Chiang Kai-shek agreed. He would halt the civil war, and he would form a united front against the Japanese. And so on Christmas Day, they gave him a plane, and Chiang Kai-shek and the young marshal flew down to Nanking to announce the civil war was over. But Jiang had made no promises to the young marshal, so he imprisoned him immediately and kept him prisoner ever after, even to this day in exile on Formosa.
Christmas 1936. At Nanking, members of the government await their president's return. In pain, he hobbles out, announces to the world, a popular front of Kuomintang and communists will now, united under his command, turn to face the menace of Japan. Japan's imperial tradition has, however, a cardinal rule. Always strike first. July 1937. The war is on. The Japanese now seek total conquest, not just another chunk of territory. They blast the heart of China in the Yangtze Valley, with Shanghai first to take the shock. The Imperial Navy shells Shanghai at point-blank range. A century since Britain first blasted China open. A generation since the bloodshed of the Boxers. Babies have grown to manhood without a year of peace. For 25 years, China has lived with warlords, guns, and terror. But now it must drink deeper of the cup of bitterness.
Nanking this morning had its 28th raid. I am speaking to you just as the echoes of exploding bombs have died down. Death comes from the clear blue sky, just as it has come to thousands of our innocent people throughout the length of our land.
November, Shanghai falls. December, Nanking is sacked and raped. Through winter and spring 38, the Japanese push up the Yangtze, destroying the decade-long achievement of Chiang Kai-shek, ravaging the cities on which all future hope of nationalist China rests. In the north, a different vision of tomorrow's China guides the communists. In a village in a mountain gulch, they make a capital, Yan'an. Headquarters have paper windows, furnishings of bamboo. Their troops are called the Chinese Eighth Route Army. But the United Front dissolves. Red generals ignore Zhang's orders. Their strategy makes an independent war against Japan.